Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week one of our bi-weekly issue, so I'll be reading you the cover stories. And our first cover story is More Young Adults Are Getting Cancer, and Researchers Are Racing to Understand Why. Dr. Frank Frizzell has operated on countless patients in his career as a colorectal surgeon, but there's one case that stayed with him. In 2014, he was treating a woman in her late 20s suffering from bowel cancer, already a rare situation given her age. But it became even more unusual when her best friend visited her in the hospital and told Frizzell that she had many of the same symptoms as his patient. Subsequent testing revealed that his patient's friend had a lesion that, had it been caught early, likely would have become cancerous. That really brought it home to me. How much more common than you think, says Frizzell, professor of surgery at the University of Otago in New Zealand. Still, like any good scientist, Frizzell says he was skeptical. It was simply a fluke that he kept treating strikingly young patients. Or was his practice one tiny data point in a larger trend? He found his answer after sifting through national health data. Colorectal cancer, he discovered, was indeed being diagnosed much more often than in previous years among New Zealanders under age 50. Further research by Frizzell, analyzing populations in Sweden and Scotland, showed the same thing. A bigger picture was emerging. Here, there were three different countries with different populations and health challenges, but united by a spike in colorectal cancer among young adults. In the year since, it's become clear that the problem isn't limited to those three countries, nor to colorectal cancer. Researchers have found that young people around the world are getting many different kinds of cancer at alarmingly high rates. And as the diagnoses of celebrities and public figures like Kate Middleton, Chadwick Boseman, Dwayne Wade, and Olivia Munn bring mass attention to the issue, scientists are racing to answer questions on the minds of many outside the medical community. Why is cancer, historically a disease of old age, increasingly striking people in the prime of their lives? Globally, diagnoses and deaths related to early onset cancers, those affecting patients younger than 50, rose by 79% and 28% respectively from 1990 to 2019, according to a recent study published in the medical journal BMJ Oncology. In the United States, breast cancer is the most common type of early onset disease, but recent surges in cancers affecting digestive organs, including the colon, rectum, pancreas, and stomach, are particularly dramatic within this age group. In fact, today's young adults are about twice as likely to be diagnosed with colon cancer and four times as likely to be diagnosed with rectal cancer as those born around 1950, research suggests. Overall, cancer is still overwhelmingly an older person's disease. As of 2025, 88% of people in the United States diagnosed with cancer were 50 or older, and 59% were 65 or older, according to data from the American Cancer Society. But there is no question that the demographics are shifting. Under 50s are not only at increasing risk of suffering from cancer, theirs is the only age group for which the risk is rising. All told, 17 types of cancer are on the rise among United States adults in this age group. When we were younger, we assumed that the climate would be the same forever. The same applies to cancer, says Dr. Thomas Powles, a UK-based oncologist and cancer researcher who edits the journal Journals of Oncology. We just assumed that cancer incidence was something that is relatively static, but it's not. There is some good news in the data. Advances in disease detection and treatment, as well as dramatic declines in smoking, mean that far fewer people die from cancer now than they once did. Although the disease still ranks as the second most common cause of death in the United States, killing more than 500,000 people each year, mortality rates have dropped by about a third since 1991. Less encouragingly, the rate of new cancers diagnosed has retained stubbornly consistent, declining only modestly from 1999 to 2021. Across the United States, roughly 2 million new cancer cases are detected each year, diagnoses that, on top of the emotional toll, force patients to cumulatively fork out billions of dollars in and out-of-pocket costs, more than $10 million in 2019 alone, according to federal data. Today, about 40 out of every 100 United States adults can expect to be diagnosed with cancer at some point in their lifetimes. For an estimated 1 in 17 U.S. women and 1 in 29 U.S. men, that news will come before their 50th birthdays. The rise in early onset diagnoses partly comes down to advances in our ability to detect and diagnose different kinds of cancers. With much more sophisticated tools now, inevitably we're doing more tests on younger people and we're using more accurate imaging, which leads to more cancers detected, Powles said. Some screening protocols have also been modified in recent years to include younger adults. Since 2018, for example, the American Cancer Society has recommended colonoscopies starting at age 45, down from 50. But this is only one part of what scientists say is a more complex web of factors that they are still attempting to understand. The data suggest that some element, or perhaps combination of elements, of modern life is sickening progressively younger adults. And right now, no one knows for sure what that is. There are plenty of known risk factors for cancer, from genes that someone is born with to the unhealthy lifestyle habits they pick up, such as smoking, drinking lots of alcohol, or spending time in the sun. Such habits can speed up the natural degradation of cells, which over time acquire genetic mutations as they lose their ability to repair damage. As that damage accumulates with age, cells may become cancerous, growing and multiplying too fast for the body's immune system to keep them in check and potentially choking out vital organs. The immune system also loses some of its strength with age, making it easier for cancer cells to colonize the body. But classic risk factors do not seem to fully explain the recent rise in early onset cancers, says Dr. Kathy Eng, director of the Young Adult Cancer Program at Vanderbilt University's Ingram Cancer Center in Tennessee. Some of the trends are baffling. Young, non-smoking women, for example, are being diagnosed with lung cancer in strangely high numbers. Many times, Eng's patients were extremely healthy, vegetarians, marathon runners, and swimmers. That's why I really believe there's other risk factors to account for this, she says. There's no shortage of theories about what those might be. Many scientists point to modern diets, which tend to be heavy on potentially carcinogenic products, including ultra-processed foods, red meat, and alcohol, and it may also contribute to weight gain, another cancer risk factor. The foods we eat can also affect the gut microbiome, the colony of microbes that lives in the digestive system and appears linked to overall health. Alterations in the gut microbiome via diet or perhaps exposure to drugs like antibiotics have also been implicated. Other researchers blame the microplastics littering our environment and leaching into our food and water supplies, some of which, according to a 2024 study, have even shown up in cancer patients' tumors. Other environmental factors could also be to blame, given that everything from cosmetics to food packaging contains substances that many researchers aren't convinced are safe. Even our near-constant exposure to artificial light could be messing with normal biological rhythms in ways that have profound health consequences, some research suggests. For now, these are all just hypotheses. Some may turn out to be wrong, and more theories will emerge in time. It's also likely that different risk factors are linked to different cancers, Frizzell says. Even in a single patient, multiple overlapping triggers may be in play. Frizzell's research on colorectal cancer, for example, suggests that there may be a dysfunctional relationship between microplastics, certain foods, and some types of gut bacteria. Studies suggest that when microplastics get into the body, they can penetrate the mucus lining that protects the bowels and carry bacteria and toxins to the bowel lining. This leaves the bowel more susceptible to damage from pathogens inside the body, including strains of gut bacteria that are known to become more virulent than when they interact with components found in red and processed meat. In some patients, this perfect storm of invaders may result in cancer, Frizzell thinks. He believes this overlapping puzzle of risk factors is a likelier explanation than any one lifestyle habit driving a dramatic uptick in cancers, especially since younger generations are in many respects healthier than their ancestors. In the United States, for example, tobacco use has plummeted in recent decades, and young adults are increasingly unlikely to drink. How is the health-conscious patient getting more bowel cancer? Frizzell asks. Dr. Andrea Cerkec, co-director of the Center for Young Onset Colorectal and Gastrointestinal Cancers at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, agrees that some early onset cancer cases defy easy explanation. She's treated patients in their 20s and even teens with tumors that biologically look just like regular 80-year-old tumors. These cases stump her. Even if they drank as a teenager, it just doesn't make sense, she says. A few years of drinking alcohol following an unhealthy diet of having obesity should not be enough to produce the kind of tumor typically seen in a senior citizen, Cerkec says. And yet, there they are. To Cerkec, these advanced tumors suggest that people have been exposed to damaging substances for a long time, perhaps even longer than they were aware of. Research and awareness about early onset cancer is accumulating now, but the source of the problem may not be new, Cerkec says. It can take years for even the most toxic exposures to result in health problems, which means that the source of a problem in the public eye now may have emerged decades ago, silently sickening people until the trend became too pronounced to ignore. Giancarlo Mori, 32, is one of many patients whose cancer defies obvious explanation. When he was in high school, Mori developed a persistent cough that didn't respond to medication. Eventually, at just 18 years old, he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Mori and his doctors were stunned. He'd had asthma as a child growing up in Peru, but he had no family history of cancer, and he'd never been a drinker or a smoker. He was barely even old enough to buy cigarettes, and still years shy of his 21st birthday. Mori's family spent a day observing the site of the 9/11 terrorist attack when toxic particles were still in the air, but it had been a brief visit, and no one else in the family had developed health problems. That was the only exposure that he could think of. The diagnosis didn't make sense. It was so weird, he says. As he went through cancer treatment, including chemotherapy, radiation, and a surgery that removed his entire left lung, he'd look at his fellow patients and, seeing how much older they were, feel out of place. I didn't belong there, he says. More than a decade later, Mori is still in treatment, participating in a clinical trial at Memorial Sloan Kettering, where all the patients pictured on these pages have received care, in hopes of ridding his body of cancer for good. But though he's still fighting cancer, he is in good health. He can even play soccer, despite having only one lung, and chase after his almost 2-year-old son. Sometimes I don't believe it, he says. I think about my son, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you are really a miracle. Figuring out how young people like Mori fall prey to cancer is not easy, given the sheer number of potential health hazards in the modern world. It is a puzzle with an unknown number of pieces. One that Dr. Shuji Ogino, a pathologist at Brigham and Women's Institute in Boston, is trying to solve with a technique that he pioneered. Ogino and his team are making their way through about 4,000 colorectal tumor examples that came from people who developed the disease at various points in their lives. Each sliver of tissue holds innumerable clues about the person it belonged to, from what they ate and drank to what bacteria lived in their body before cancer took root. To unearth these clues, the researchers stain the tissues so that under the lens of a powerful microscope, they can see the different types of cells in the tumor in brilliant color. Using these cell-level insights, they can distinguish between the tumors of young versus older patients and, with the help of AI, search teams of scientific literature for environmental exposure, lifestyle habits, or health conditions linked to particular cellular traits. Repeating this painstaking detective work enough times helps reveal patterns among young cancer patients, giving Ogino and his team clues as to what may have caused their diseases. Their research has already pointed to some possible answers for early onset colorectal cancer. The big three so far are eating a typical Western diet, including sugar, processed foods, and red meat, low in fresh produce, developing insulin resistance, a precursor to diabetes, also linked to a poor diet, and having a particular type of E. coli bacteria in the gut. Nothing is proven yet, Ogino says. But since there's no harm in eating healthfully, he believes dietary changes are worth making now. Ogino personally drinks very little and eats a healthy diet. He makes sure his young son eats well too, since his research makes him acutely aware of the importance of developing healthy habits starting from a very young age. But even for children, as young as Ogino's son, some damage may already be done, at least according to Dr. George Barreto, a surgeon and cancer researcher at Flinders University in South Australia. Barreto, who started researching early onset cancer after not just his patients, but also several of his relatives and friends were diagnosed at young ages, has theorized that damage may start in the womb. It's well established that the prenatal period can have long-term effects on a baby's health, and Barreto believes that phenomenon may extend to cancer risk if parents are exposed to carcinogens during this critical developmental time. This theory could help explain mysterious cases like those that Sercek describes involving patients who seemingly haven't lived long enough for even their riskiest habits to catch up with them. Proving his theory won't be simple, Barreto acknowledges. It would require collecting data on huge numbers of people, starting before they were even born, then sifting through that data to pinpoint relevant prenatal and early life triggers. To speed up the process, Barreto has contacted more than 20 research groups around the world that are tracking groups of people beginning at or before birth in hopes of using their data to jumpstart his research. If we start from scratch now, it'll take 40 years to find answers, Barreto says. That's too long to wait, with patients already getting sick at an alarming rate. There is yet another question for researchers to answer, whether, on a molecular level, young patients' cancers are dramatically different from those that occur in older people. If so, these findings may guide researchers toward new treatment approaches. Some research, including by Eng, has pointed to molecular differences, at least among patients with early-onset colorectal disease. But other scientists are less convinced. Pals, the UK oncologist, says he hasn't seen strong enough evidence to suggest that early-onset cancers are much different or more aggressive than later-in-life cancers. They just happen to strike patients at younger ages. Even if there is no medical requirement to stray from classic treatment methods, like chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, younger patients have unique needs. Standard treatments, while often effective, can be destructive for people with decades of life already ahead of them, potentially leading to life-altering physical changes, like permanently needing a colostomy bag or enduring early menopause and infertility. The worst thing for an oncologist to hear is, "I'm cured and my cancer is gone. But I wish that I just lived with my cancer, because living like this isn't living," Sercek says. Kelly Spill was blindsided when she was diagnosed with stage 3 colorectal cancer in 2020. She was only 28, had no family history of colorectal cancer, and had recently given birth to her first child. She was even more stunned when she learned that her treatment would force her to permanently use a colostomy bag and leave her unable to carry more children. "That completely broke me," she says. "I'd always wanted a big family." Just before she was set to start chemotherapy, however, a research nurse told her she might be fit for an experimental trial that Sercek was leading. Sercek was testing a new approach among patients whose tumors had a specific genetic mutation, using intravenous medication to boost their immune system ability to recognize and attack cancerous cells, ideally sparing patients from chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. Despite all the unknowns that came with participating in a clinical trial, Spill says it was a no-brainer to try Sercek's approach. instead of therapies that would leave her with lifelong physical side effects. Her gamble paid off. By her 9th treatment session, her tumor had entirely disappeared, and Spill is still cancer-free and expecting her 3rd baby in May. In June, Sercheck reported that out of 41 rectal cancer patients who completed the full regimen, 100% were cancer-free and required no additional treatment. She is now also studying the method against a variety of different cancers, ranging from stomach to bladder. A patient of any age could benefit from this approach, Sercheck says, but it could be particularly impactful for young patients like Spill who are desperate to avoid permanent side effects. Even without novel medical approaches, cancer screeners are beginning to recognize that compared with elderly patients, adolescents and young adults have very different experiences and therefore need very different approaches to their treatment, says Allison Sibelman, CEO of Stupid Cancer, a nonprofit that supports young people with the disease. Physical fallout isn't the only hurdle to overcome, Silberman says. Compared with older patients, young people are more likely to struggle to pay for their care and develop mental health issues as a result of it. Silberman witnesses these challenges when her brother was diagnosed with advanced cancer in his 20s. He was yanked out of his life, forced to leave his job and apartment to move back in with their parents, Silberman remembers. Cancer made him grapple with his own mortality, largely on his own. He was too old to be a pediatric patient and too young to be an adult patient, she says. That was very isolating for him. Care of the early onset cancer patients becomes complex even beyond medicine, says Dr. Ved Jiri, an oncologist and co-director of Yale Cancer Center's Early Onset Cancer Program in Connecticut. This spring, the program will launch new services meant to address that very problem. Patients in the program will be contacted by coordinators who can help guide them through the issues that commonly affect young adult patients, from ways to preserve fertility to deciding whether to pursue genetic testing or enroll in a clinical trial. Patients can also participate in support groups with others in their age group in hopes of improving social and mental health. The goal? To support patients and their families from diagnosis all the way through their cancer journey and beyond into survivorship, says, since young adults cured of cancer may have continued needs for decades to come, Jiri says. The ultimate goal, of course, and the ultimate win for doctors and researchers working in this field will be for early onset cancer centers to be rendered unnecessary. But it likely won't happen anytime soon. Proponents of sophisticated new artificial intelligence technologies have raised expectations, promising new tools that could transform cancer research. AI gives scientists the ability to sift through mountains of data and hitherto unimaginable levels of precision. And the hope is that these tools will unlock a cascade of new discoveries, illuminating unrecognizable risk factors, for example, and turbocharging the development of new treatments. But cancer researchers remain cautious. There is hope, no doubt, but the legions of scientists grappling with complex medical puzzles in other fields, they are wary of overstating the pace of progress and raising the hopes of patients, even with new technologies at their disposal. It will be impossible to design a clinical trial that can test all the different possible causes of early onset cancer, says Dr. Andrew Chan, Director of Cancer Epidemiology at Mass General Cancer Center. AI and other technologies may help land on those possible causes faster, but to really understand exactly what's driving the disease and how to stop it, researchers must work slowly and methodically, studying various potential triggers, from diet to alcohol to microplastics, one by one. Chan's team is starting with a trial that will study whether losing weight with the help of GLP-1 drugs like Wegovy and Zepbound affect future cancer risk among people who have survived early onset cancer and who are overweight. Future researchers may study the effects of specific dietary changes, he says. But not all potential cancer triggers are as straightforward to modify as weight and diet. Take microplastics, which Frizzell, the New Zealand surgeon, believes are contributing to early onset cancer. Frizzell is realistic about their ubiquity. Avoiding them is all but impossible in a world where water supplies are tainted and babies suckle on plastic bottles from their earliest days on Earth. Barreto's research on the cancer risk starting in the womb paints an even bleaker picture, suggesting that the deck may be stacked against some people before they are really people at all. He chooses to see it more optimistically, noting that everyone can still take the power into their own hands by avoiding known carcinogens. The upshot of all this, it could take years, if not decades, to sort out what's causing early diagnoses and perhaps even more time to figure out how to stop them. What seems obvious to us now, the conclusion that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer, for example, took some 40 years for scientists to solidify. Even once they did, change didn't happen overnight. Smoking rates have fallen steadily since public health warnings escalated in the 1960s, but they didn't plummet all at once. Still, change is possible. Today, smoking is at historic lows, and lung cancer diagnoses have declined with them. If this challenge sounds daunting for researchers like Ogino from Brigham and Women's, the complexities are part of the process. He is reminded every day that good science takes as long as it takes. Many of the tumor samples that he relies on in his research came from participants enrolled in a study that launched in 1976. The researchers who started couldn't have known that 50 years later, their work would be critical in the quest to reverse the rise of early onset cancer, Ogino says. That's the kind of legacy that you can make in science, he says. That's a great, rewarding way to contribute, even if it takes a lot of time to get there. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds, and this is week one of Time Magazine. We've just read the cover story on early onset cancer, and now we're going to move to the second cover story, which is called The Closers, and this is about Black people who are working to end racism. And we have four categories. We have healers, we have innovators, we have advocates, and we have leaders. And we're going to start with healers, and our first one is Coleman Domingo. If you can't spend an hour or two with Coleman Domingo in real life, you can still find the key to his spirit in a photograph from when he was age 6, a pint-sized gent perched between his older sister and brother, wearing a candy-striped blazer so groovy you wouldn't be surprised to see it on Sammy Davis Jr. at a Coconut Grove show. He brought this picture along when he appeared on The View in November, and after the show host had finished cooing, he provided the backstory. The navy pants he's wearing had a matching jacket, but it was too small. He grabbed the striped one instead, though his mother said it didn't quite match. "But it makes me feel good," he told her, and instead of arguing, she told him, "Wear what makes you feel good," setting him on the path that he follows to this day. Domingo, 55, is known for his creative yet classic red carpet style, inspired by influences ranging from Fred Astaire to the Ohio Players, Cary Grant to Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. It makes perfect sense that he has been named a chair of this spring's Met Gala, the theme of which is Superfine, Tailoring Black Style. Style is integral to his spirit, a way of communicating, of pushing out in the world, of connecting with black men and women who came before him, which is to say that anyone who believes that style is superficial hasn't met Domingo. How he dresses, how he moves, how he sips from a coffee cup, all these things are so casually entwined with who he is that they charge the air around him. Generosity begins with the self, and Domingo is so at ease that he has extra grace to spare. "Everything I do is about radical love," Domingo says, over coffee at the Chelsea Hotel in New York City. "It's about seeing each other. What am I doing as a creative? It's about getting people to think, maybe helping people to think differently. You know, that's all I can do. The macro I can't take care of, but I can take care of the micro." Domingo earned his Best Actor Academy Award nomination for his superb performance in Sing Sing, Greg Kwadar's drawn-from-real-life film about men who find redemption through a prison theater program. It's his second nod in as many years. He was also recognized for his turn as civil rights activist Bayard Rustin in George C. Wolfe's biopic Rustin. He's the anchor of Netflix's multi-part thriller, The Madness. And the projects he's got going stack far into the sky. He'll play Joe Jackson in Antoine Fuqua's upcoming Michael Jackson's biopic and star in Tina Fey's series, The Four Seasons. He's ready to direct and star in a Nat King Cole biopic. He's written and to direct a drama about the romance between Sammy Davis Jr. and Kim Novak, too. But even if the spotlight around Domingo now seems particularly bright, he has, in fact, been everywhere for a while now. In the early 2000s, he splashed out in Broadway shows like Passing Strange and The Scottsboro Boys, garnering a Tony nomination for the latter. In 2022, he won a Primetime Emmy for his recurring role in Euphoria. Moviegoers know him from pictures like Lincoln, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Zola, and The Color Purple. "How can I say it?" he says. "I did not intend for this at all. I wanted to be a respected actor, and I found my work as a character, mostly in the theater. I feel like that's where I was most useful, and that's where I was best served." Still, after working as one sort of performer or another for some 35 years, he's grateful for, and more than a little surprised, at all the extra attention that he's gotten in the past 5 years or so. "I'm like, ooh, did I get to have an impact? What can I do? What can I disrupt?" He laughs, a sonorous laugh that sounds as if it could have rolled in from the ocean, even though Domingo was born and grew up in West Philly. "That's what I want to do, and really do it in the most loving, gracious, and generous way possible." One of Domingo's early gigs was as a party starter for bar mitzvahs, getting recalcitrant guests out on the dance floor. Though he has no formal dance training, He moves through the world on springy, lithe stem legs, and it's hard to imagine Mrs. Rosenzweig or anyone else resisting his effervescence. But given the way he carries himself, it's likely that Domingo also offered something else, not just charm and fancy footwork, but safety, the feeling that if you join him, he'll have your back. His friends today seem to feel that way too. Writer-director and actor Bradley Cooper met Domingo when the two found themselves on the award circuit last year. Cooper for his Leonard Bernstein biopic Maestro, and Domingo for Rustin. They exchanged numbers and kept in touch. Domingo says that Cooper has been a great sounding board for him. For his Nat King Cole project, Cooper demurs. He doesn't think he's helped that much, but he values having a friend that he can talk to about projects that matter. Anytime he's asked me something, I actually feel privileged that he even wants my input, he says. Cooper is also simply happy to have found a true friend. As you get older, you tend not to make new friends, but I made a new friend, which is kind of wonderful. And he allows that space to be a friend to somebody, which is beautiful. Domingo, like Cooper, has ideas to spare. He's eager to take on bigger and more ambitious projects, more disruption of the loving, gracious, generous kind, but lots of successful people. He's earned his self-assurance day by day. I'm happy that I'm being met in this moment on my terms. I didn't have to become some kind of other artist who has to leave parts of themselves behind. I bring all of me into it. I bring all my years as a theater practitioner, as a director, as a writer, as a producer, even when the industry wanted me to just pick one. Showcasing his talent across film and TV, Domingo has broadened his scope in a way that allows him to share the wealth. All through 2024, as studio and streaming execs balked at greenlighting risky or ambitious projects, even as many who make their living in TV and movies were scrambling to recover not just from the pandemic, but from the actors and writers' strikes, the motto of many who'd seen work dry up was, survive till 25. And that was before the horrific Los Angeles wildfires. Domingo's house in Malibu was spared. So while he's riding high, he's using his career not just to climb higher, but also to lift others. His involvement with Sing Sing as an actor and producer is a case in point. When he happened to play John Divine G. Whitheld, a man wrongly imprisoned who finds a lifetime in the arts, Quadar, along with the film's other writers and producers, suggested a parody model in which everyone would be paid the same. Domingo loved the idea. My heart just opened. I don't know if it works for every project, but I think there are elements of it that can work, especially when it comes to low-budget features. You're doing it because you love it, and you want to be a part of it. And when the project succeeds, everyone benefits, not just a few key people at the top. I think that's just fair, Domingo says. Domingo's co-star, Clarence McLean, is a veteran of the program that inspired the film, Rehabilitation Through the Arts, and one of the many formerly incarcerated men who have roles in the movie. McLean, who got his acting training at Sing Sing, with its terrible acoustics and sucky sound system, knew how to project. Domingo helped him tailor his performance to the intimacy of the camera. But what McLean took away goes beyond mere tips about technique. He's the genuine article when it comes to someone who definitely is going to be there, someone who means what they say about what they want to do and what their intentions are, he says. The things I want to be, I see in him already. The idea, as McLean clearly gets, is that living in the world means so much more than looking out for number one. I met with Domingo 3 weeks after the election, at a time when many were feeling stunned by the results. As a gay black man, he knows that the road ahead might be bumpy, but when he woke up on November 6th, he didn't panic. Instead, I thought, okay, this is where we are. Again, he vibrates with so much radiant energy that it's impossible to feel hopeless around him. The pendulum does swing, he says. My parents went through a lot. My grandparents went through even worse. And I am here, where I am in my life, but also as a proud descendant of slaves who lived, loved, and fought and sacrificed so I could be here. So I can't hold my head down and be sad or despondent about anything. I have to roll up my sleeves and continue to get to work. Fight, love, be joyful in a very revolutionary way. This is how you honor those who came before you, while also opening a corridor for everyone who will follow. This is how you get the party started. Our next healer in our special feature on closers is Lisa Holder, President, Equal Justice Society. In 2021, a black homeowner in Marin County shared a chilling story with the California Separations Task Force. He and his wife had renovated their home, adding value through upgrades and improvements. But when an appraiser assessed the property, in came hundreds of thousands of dollars below expectations. The couple, suspecting racial bias, then enlisted a white friend to pose as the homeowner. The valuation soared by nearly another $500,000. The story underscored the relevance of the first-of-its-kind body established in 2020 to investigate the effects of systemic racism in the state and develop proposals to address the harm done to Black Californians. It was also a defining moment for one of the task force members, Lisa Holder, the president of the Equal Justice Society, EJS, who sees such anecdotes as not outliers, but as part of an entrenched pattern. In 2023, the task force released a groundbreaking report with policy recommendations ranging from financial compensation to sweeping reforms in education, housing, and criminal justice. One of the most significant outcomes has been the passage of several reparation bills, including one that requires California to formally apologize for perpetuating slavery. Apologies are so important in reparation, Holder says, because instead of placing the blame on the people who have been harmed and oppressed, you're finally placing the blame on the institutions that have caused that harm and oppression and inequality. Holder, 53, has spent more than two decades working to dismantle systems of racial oppression. A leader in civil rights law, she has focused on education, equity employment, discrimination, and constitutional policing. Before taking the helm at EJS in 2022, she played a key role in a 2019 lawsuit that resulted in the elimination of the SAT-ACT as admissions requirements for the University of California system. The case struck down a significant barrier to higher education for many Black and Latino students. It's challenging work, and reparations in particular remain controversial. But while Holder acknowledges the resistance, she remains resolute in her belief that the case for reparations is morally irrefutable, Reparations are not just about a check in the mail, she says. It's about changing systems that were designed to harm so that they can never harm again. Our next healer, folks, is Eugenia Millender, founder for the Center of Population Sciences for Health Equity at Florida State University. Becoming a nurse was practically a given for Eugenia Millender, who began her years of health service by helping her grandmother, who didn't like needles, with her insulin injections. Born in Panama, Millender grew up in a racially diverse family and a community. My mom is Afro-Latina, Panamanian, and my father was indigenous Guana Panamanian, she says. When she was 12, she arrived in Brooklyn with her mother, who was hoping to give her a better life. They experienced poverty, and Millender saw firsthand the inequities in the access and quality of health care that people received. My mother did not speak English, and when she tried to get care, people ignored her. Millender, 53, moved to Florida as a teen and joined the Army after high school, which allowed her to earn her undergraduate and master's degree in nursing. Working in emergency departments, which often care for the uninsured, she witnessed families struggling with the same challenges that her mother had. You know that they don't have the resources to take care of their loved ones once they are discharged from the hospital, or they don't understand what the doctors and nurses are telling them because they speak a different language or an indigenous language. Now a tenured professor at Florida State University College of Nursing, Millender co-founded and serves as co-director of the Center of Population Sciences for Health Equity, which focuses on addressing the causes of health inequities, from language and cultural barriers to mental health challenges. Building off her own experiences, Millender takes time to learn from communities about their needs and the obstacles they face. That includes incorporating, rather than dismissing, cultural beliefs in community-based programs that connect people with health care given for the first time. If an individual believes in green tea as part of their regimen, then you need to include green tea as part of their medication list when you do an intake, she says. Do not ignore, do not ask questions about it, but include these holistic approaches as part of the treatment plan. Recently, Millender has seen her efforts come full circle with programs that she has launched in her native Panama to improve healthcare for indigenous people. I feel very privileged, so I have to give back, she says. And folks, that concludes our program for today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening in Time Magazine cover stories, and we will continue next week with more of the closers and the brief and the view articles in Time Magazine. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.